in one of the empty rooms. She set up an emergency refuge, never thinking that she would have to keep him hidden for several months while the soldiers combed the country looking for him. Blanca assumed that it would occur to no one to think that Pedro Tercero Garcia was in Senator Trueba's house at the very moment when the senator was attending the Te Deum in the cathedral. It was the happiest period of Blanca's life. But for Pedro Tercero, the hours passed as slowly as if he were in jail. He spent his day shut within four walls behind a locked door, so that no one would happen to walk in to clean his room, and the blinds lowered and the curtains drawn. Daylight could not come in, but he was able to recognize it by the tenuous change in the cracks of the blinds. At night, he opened the window as wide as he could to air out the room, where he had to keep a covered pail in which to relieve himself and to inhale great mouthfuls of the air of freedom. He spent his time reading Jaime's books, which Blanca brought him on the sly, and listening to the street sounds and to the whisper of the radio, which he kept at the lowest volume. Blanca managed to bring him a guitar and stuffed some rags beneath the strings so no one would hear him, composing muted songs of widows, orphans, prisoners, and the disappeared. He tried to work out a schedule to organize his day. He did calisthenics, read, studied English, took a siesta, wrote music, and did some more calisthenics. But even with all this, he had endless amounts of spare time until he finally heard the key turn in the lock and saw Blanca coming through the door with newspapers, food, and clean water for him to wash with. They made love desperately, inventing forbidden formulas that fear and passion transformed into wild journeys to the stars. Blanca had already resigned herself to chastity, middle age, and her various aches and pains. But the shock of love had brought her a new youth. The sheen of her skin, the rhythm of her gait, and the cadence of her voice all became more pronounced. She smiled inwardly and walked around like a woman asleep. She had never been more beautiful, even her father noticed, attributing it to the peace of abundance. Ever since Blanca stopped having to stand in line, she looks like a new woman, Senator Trueba remarked. Alba also noticed it. She watched her mother. Her strange somnambulism seemed suspicious to her, as did her new mania for taking food to her room. On more than one occasion, she set out to spy on her during the night, but she was overcome by the fatigue of her own many acts of consolation, and when she had insomnia, she was afraid to venture into the empty rooms that were full of whispering ghosts. Pedro Tercero grew thin and lost the good humor and sweetness that had characterized him up till then. He was bored. He cursed his voluntary imprisonment and raged impatiently for news of his friends. Only Blanca's presence could pacify him. When she entered the room, he hurled himself upon her like a madman to calm the terrors of the day and the tedium of his weeks. He began to be obsessed by the idea that he was a coward and a traitor for not having shared the fate of so many others, and felt that it would be more honorable to surrender and meet his fate. Blanca tried to dissuade him with the best of arguments, but he seemed not to hear her. She tried to hold him back with the force of her newfound love, fed him with her hands, bathed him by rubbing him with a damp cloth, and dusting him with powder like an infant, cut his hair and fingernails, and even shaved him. Finally, she had no choice but to put tranquilizers in his food and sleeping pills in his water, which stunned him into a profound, tormented sleep, from which he would awake with a dry mouth and a sadder heart. After a few months, Blanca realized she could not hold him prisoner indefinitely and gave up her plans to reduce his spirit in order to make him her permanent lover. She understood that he was being eaten up alive because, for him, freedom was even more important than love. and that there were no magic pills that would make him change his mind. "Help me, Father," Blanca begged Senator Trueba. "I have to get him out of the country." The old man was paralyzed with bewilderment, recognizing how worn out he was when he tried to summon up his fury and his hatred and was unable to find them. He thought of the peasant who had shared his daughter's love for half a century and was unable to find a single reason for detesting him, not even his poncho. His socialist beard, his tenacity, or his damned fox-chasing hens.
"Hell," he exclaimed. "We'll have to get him asylum, because if they find him here, we'll all be screwed,"
was all he could think to say. Blanca threw her arms around his neck and covered him with kisses, weeping like a child. It was the first spontaneous hug she had given her father since her most remote childhood.
"I can get him into an embassy," Alba said, "but we have to wait for the right moment, and he'll have to leap over a wall."
"That won't be necessary, my dear," Senator Trueba replied. "I still have some influential friends in this country."
48 hours later, the door to Pedro Tercero Garcia's room swung open. This time, instead of Blanca, Senator Trueba was standing in the doorway. The fugitive thought his final hour had arrived and, in a strange way, he was happy.
"I've come to get you out of here," Trueba said.
"Why?"
Pedro Tercero asked.
"Because Blanca asked me to," the other answered.
"Go to hell," Pedro Tercero said.
"Fine. That's where we're going. You're coming with me."
The two of them smiled simultaneously. The silver limousine of a Nordic ambassador was waiting in the courtyard. Pedro Tercero was put in the trunk of the car, curled up like a package and covered with market baskets full of fruit and vegetables. Blanca, Alba, Senator Trueba, and their friend the ambassador rode inside the car. The chauffeur drove them to the residence of the papal nuncio, passing in front of a police barricade without anyone attempting to stop them. There was a double guard stationed at the nunciature gate, but when they recognized Senor Trueba and saw the diplomatic plates on the car, they let him in with a salute. Behind the gate, safely within the seat of the Vatican, they let Pedro Tercero out from under a mountain of lettuce leaves and bruised tomatoes. They led him to the office of the nuncio, who was waiting for him dressed in his bishop's cassock and holding a new safe conduct pass that would allow him to go abroad with Blanca, who had decided to live out in exile the love she had postponed since her childhood. The nuncio welcomed them. He was an admirer of Pedro Tercero Garcia and had all his records. While the priest and the Nordic ambassador discussed the international situation, the family said goodbye. Blanca and Alba wept disconsolately. They had never been separated before. Esteban Trueba gave his daughter a long hug. He did not cry, but his mouth was clamped shut, and he shook from the effort of holding back his sobs.
"I haven't been a good father to you, my dear," he said. "Do you think you'll ever be able to forgive me and forget the past?"
"I love you so much, Papa," Blanca wept, throwing her arms around his neck, clasping him to her ardently, and covering his face with kisses. After that, the old man turned to Pedro Tercero and looked him in the eye. He stretched out his hand, but he did not know how to shake Pedro's hand because it was missing several fingers. Instead, he opened his arms and the two men said goodbye in a tight knot, free at last of the hatred and rancor that had poisoned their lives for so many years.
"I'll take good care of your daughter, and I will try to make her happy," Pedro Tercero Garcia said, his voice breaking.
"I have no doubt of that."
"Go in peace, my children," the old man murmured.
He knew he would never see them again.
Senator Treba was left alone in the house with his granddaughter and a few remaining servants. At least that was what he thought. But Alba had decided to adopt her mother's plan and was using the abandoned wing of the house to hide people for a night or two until she found a safer place or a way to get them out of the country. She helped those who lived in shadow, fleeing by day and mingling with the bustle of the city, but who had to be hidden by nightfall, always in a different place. The most dangerous time was during the curfew, when fugitives could not be out on the street and the police could hunt them down at will. Alba thought her grandfather's house was the last place they would search. Slowly but surely, she transformed the empty rooms into a labyrinth of secret nooks where she hid those she took under her wing, sometimes whole families. Senator Treba used only the library, the bathroom, and his bedroom. There he lived surrounded by his mahogany furniture, his Victorian glass cabinets, and his Persian carpets. Even for a man so little given to intuition as he was, the dark mansion was disquieting. It seemed to hold a hidden monster. Treba could not understand the reason for his uneasiness, because he knew that the strange noises the servants said they heard were made by Clara as she wandered through the house in the company of her spirit friends. He had often come upon his wife, gliding through the sitting rooms in her white tunic, with her young girl's laugh. He pretended not to see her, not moving and even holding his breath so as not to frighten her. If he closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep, he could feel her fingers gently stroking his forehead, her fresh breath touching him like a breeze, her hair brushing against his hand. He had no reason to suspect anything irregular. And yet, he tried not to venture into the enchanted realm that belonged to his wife. The farthest he went was the neutral zone of the kitchen. His old cook had left because her husband had been accidentally shot, and her only son, who was doing his military service in a village in the south, had been hanged from a post with his guts wrapped around his neck, the people's revenge for his having carried out the orders of his superiors. The poor woman had lost her mind, and soon afterward, Treba lost his patience, fed up with finding in his food the hairs she had torn from her head in her unending grief. For a while, Alba experimented with the pots, using a cookbook, but despite her good intentions, Treba wound up dining almost every night at his club, so he could have at least one decent meal a day. That gave Alba greater freedom for her traffic in fugitives, and greater safety for bringing people in and taking them out of the house before curfew, without her grandfather suspecting. One day, Miguel appeared. She was entering the house in the broad light of the siesta hour when he came walking toward her. He had been waiting for her, hidden in the thick weeds of the garden. He had dyed his hair pale yellow and was wearing a blue checked suit. He looked like an ordinary bank employee, but Alba recognized him immediately and was unable to stifle the shout of joy that rose up from within her. They embraced in the garden, in view of the passers-by and anyone who'd care to look, until they came to their senses and understood how dangerous it was. Alba led him inside the house to her bedroom. They fell onto the bed in a knot of arms and legs, each calling the other by the secret names they had used in the days of the basement. They made love impatiently until they felt that the very life was flowing out of them and their souls were bursting. Then they were forced to lie quiet, listening to the pounding of their hearts, in order to calm down a little. Looking at him for the first time, Alba saw that she had been cavorting with what looked like a total stranger, who not only had the hair of a Viking, but also lacked the beard of Miguel and his small round schoolmaster's spectacles, and seemed much thinner.
You look horrible, she whispered in his ear.
Miguel had become one of the guerrilla leaders, fulfilling the destiny he had been moving toward ever since he was a teenager. Many men and women had been interrogated to find out his whereabouts, a fact which weighed on Alba's spirit like a millstone. But for him, it was simply another part of the horror of war, and he was prepared to suffer the same fate when the moment came to cover up for others. Meanwhile, he fought clandestinely, faithful to his theory that the violence of the rich must be met by the violence of the people. Alba, who had imagined 1,000 times over that he was a prisoner, or that he had been put to death in the most dreadful manner, wept with joy as she savored his scent, his texture, his voice, his warmth, the brush of his hands, calloused from handling weapons, and the habit of crawling on all fours, praying, cursing, and kissing him at the same time that she hated him for all the accumulated suffering and wished she could die there on the spot so she would never have to feel his absence again.
You were right, Miguel, Alba said, burying her face in his shoulder. Everything happened exactly as you said.
Then she told him of the weapons she had stolen from her grandfather and hidden with her uncle Jaime, and she offered to take him to look for them. She would also have liked to give him those she had been unable to steal, which had remained in the house. But a few days after the coup, the civilian population had been ordered to surrender anything that could pass for arms, from scout knives to children's penknives. People had left their little bundles wrapped in newspaper at the doors of the churches because they were afraid to take them to the barracks. But Senator Trueba, who had real weapons in his possession, was not the least bit worried. His had been stockpiled for killing communists, as everybody knew. He called up his friend, General Hurtado, who sent a truck to pick them up. Trueba led the soldiers to his personal arsenal and, mute with surprise, was amazed to find that half the boxes were filled with stones and straw, but he realized that if he admitted to the loss, he would be compromising a member of his own family, or getting himself into a jam. He began to make apologies, which no one paid any attention to, since the soldiers could hardly know how many weapons he had purchased. He suspected Blanca and Pedro Tercero Garcia, but his granddaughter's flushed cheeks also made him wonder. After the soldiers had removed the boxes, handing him a signed receipt, he took Alba by the shoulders and shook her as he never had before, to make her confess that she had something to do with the missing machine guns and rifles.
"Don't ask me questions you don't want to know the answer to," Alba replied, looking him in the eye.
They never spoke of the matter again.
"Your grandfather is a bastard, Alba," Miguel told her. "Someday someone will kill him and give him what he deserves."
"He'll die in bed. He's very old now," Alba said.
"He who lives by the sword must die by the sword. Maybe I'll kill him myself one of these days."
"God forbid, Miguel, because then I'd have to do the same to you," Alba answered fervently.
Miguel explained to her that they would not be able to see each other for a long while, perhaps never again. He tried to make her understand the danger of being the woman of a guerrilla, even if she was protected by her grandfather's name. But she wept so and hugged him with such anxiety that he was forced to promise her that they would find a way to meet from time to time, even at the risk of their lives. Miguel also agreed to go with her and dig up the guns and ammunition buried in the mountains, because that was what he most needed in his reckless fight.
"I hope they haven't rusted in the ground," Alba murmured, "and that I'll be able to remember exactly where we hid them, because it was more than a year ago."
2 weeks later, Alba organized an outing for the children from the soup kitchen. They used a truck they were lent by the parish priests. She carried baskets of food, a bag of oranges, balls, and a guitar. None of the children paid attention when she stopped along the way to pick up a blonde man. Alba drove the heavy van with its load of children along the same mountain route she had followed with her Uncle Jaime. She was stopped by two patrols and had to open all the food baskets, but the children's contagious gaiety and the innocent contents of the baskets sent all suspicion flying. They arrived calmly at the place where the arms were buried. The children played hide-and-seek. Miguel organized a football match. Then he sat them in a circle and told them stories, and afterward they all sang until they were hoarse. Later he sketched a map of the site to enable him to return with his comrades under cover of darkness. It was a happy day in the country, during which they were able to forget for a few hours the tension of the state of war and enjoy the warm mountain sun, listening to the children's shouts as they raced among the rocks, their stomachs full for the first time in months.
"I'm scared, Miguel," Alba said. "Aren't we ever going to be able to lead a normal life? Why don't we go abroad? Why don't we escape now, while we still can?"
Miguel pointed to the children, and Alba understood what he meant.
"Then let me go with you,"
she begged, as she had so many times before. "Right now we can't take someone who hasn't been trained, much less a girl in love," Miguel smiled.
"It's more important for you to continue what you're doing. These poor kids need all the help they can get until things get better."
"At least tell me how to find you."
"If the police ever get hold of you, it's better if you don't know anything," Miguel replied. She shuddered.
During the following months, Alba began to sell the furniture in the house. At first, she dared to take only what was in the abandoned rooms and the basement. But when she had sold everything there, she took the antique chairs from the drawing room, one by one, the Baroque room dividers, the colonial chests, the engraved screens, and even the dining room linens. Treba noticed but said nothing. He supposed that his granddaughter was giving the money to a forbidden cause, just as he imagined she had done with the weapons she had stolen. But he preferred not to know about it in order to retain his precarious stability in a world that was crumbling beneath his feet. He realized that all he really cared about was losing his granddaughter, because she was his last link to life. This was why he also said nothing when she took the paintings from the walls and the antique carpets to sell them to the nouveau riches. He felt very old and tired, and did not have the strength to fight. His ideas were not as clear as they had been, and the line between what was good and what was bad had blurred. During the night, when he was overcome by sleep, he had nightmares of small brick houses in flames. He thought that if his only heir was going to squander his fortune, he would do nothing to stop her, because he was going to be in his grave soon, and all he would take with him was his shroud. Alba tried to speak to him, to explain what she was doing, but the old man refused to hear the story of the starving children who received a dish of charity with a profit from his Aubusson tapestry, or the unemployed who were able to last another week thanks to his jade Chinese dragon. All this, he continued to maintain, was a monstrous communist lie. But in the remote event that it was true, it would still not be Alba's responsibility to shoulder the burden, but the government's, or, as a last resort, the church's. Nevertheless, the day he came home and did not see Clara's portrait hanging in the entry, he decided that matters had gone too far and confronted his granddaughter.
"Where the devil is the portrait of your grandmother?" he lowered.
"I sold it to the British consul. He told me he would put it in a museum in London."
"I forbid you to take another thing out of this house. Starting tomorrow, you'll have your own bank account for pin money," he said.
Esteban Trueba soon saw that Alba was the most expensive woman of his life, and that a whole harem would have cost him less than that green-haired granddaughter. He never reproached her, for his good luck had returned, and the more he spent, the more he had. After political activity had been forbidden, he had more time for his business matters, and he calculated that, against all his predictions, he was going to die a very rich man. He placed his money in the new investment houses that promised to multiply money overnight. He discovered that being rich was terribly annoying because it was so easy to make money and so difficult to find an incentive for spending it. Not even his granddaughter's prodigious talent for extravagance was able to make a dent in his purse. He enthusiastically embarked on the reconstruction and improvement of Tres Marias, but after that, he lost all interest in any other endeavor, because he noticed that, thanks to the new economic system, there was no need to work hard and produce, inasmuch as money makes money, and his bank accounts grew fatter every day without the slightest effort on his part. Thus, tallying up his accounts, he took a step he had never thought he would take in his life. Once a month, he sent a check to Pedro Tercero Garcia, who was living with Blanca in exile in Canada, where they both felt completely fulfilled in the peace of satisfied love. Pedro Tercero composed revolutionary songs for workers, students, and above all, the upper middle class, which had made his music, successfully translated into French and English, their own, despite the fact that chickens and foxes are underdeveloped creatures that lack the zoological splendor of the eagles and wolves of that frozen country of the north. Meanwhile, placid and happy, Blanca was in splendid health for the first time in her life. She set up an enormous kiln in her house to fire her creches of monsters, which sold extremely well as examples of indigenous folk art, just as Jean de Satigny had predicted 25 years earlier when he had wanted to export them. The combination of this business, her father's checks, and assistance from the Canadian government gave them more than enough to live on. Just to be on the safe side, however, Blanca hid the woolen sock with Clara's jewels in the most secret place she could find. She hoped that she would never have to sell them, and that one day they would shine for Alba. Esteban Trueba never knew that the political police had his house under surveillance until the night they came for Alba. They were both asleep, and by sheer chance, there was no one hidden in the labyrinth of empty rooms in the back of the house. The slam of rifle butts against the door shook the old man from his sleep with a clear foreboding of misfortune. But Alba had already been awakened by the sounds of brakes, the loud footsteps, and the hushed orders, and had begun to dress herself because she had no doubt that her time had come. Throughout these months, the senator had learned that not even his own record as a supporter of the coup was any guarantee against terror, but he had never imagined that he would see a dozen plainclothes men break into his house under cover of curfew, armed to the teeth, to drag him from his bed and push him into the sitting room, without even allowing him to put on his slippers or throw a shawl over his shoulders. He saw them kick open Alba's bedroom door and storm in with machine guns in their hands, and he saw his granddaughter waiting for them. She was already dressed, and though her face was pale, she looked serene. She saw them push her out and take her at gunpoint to the drawing room, where they ordered her to stand beside him and not move. She obeyed without saying a word, oblivious to her grandfather's anger and the violence of the men who were ransacking the house, kicking down doors, rifling wardrobes, knocking over furniture, ripping open mattresses, emptying dresser drawers, kicking the walls, and shouting orders in their search for hidden guerrillas, contraband weapons, and any other evidence they could find. They pulled the maids from their beds and locked them in a room
where an armed man stood guard. They ransacked the bookshelves in the study, sending the senator's bibliots and works of arts crashing to the floor. The books from Jaime's den were piled in the courtyard, doused with gasoline, and set on fire in an infamous pyre that was fed with the magic books from the enchanted trunks of Great Uncle Marcos, the remaining copies of Nicolás's esoteric treatise, the leather-bound set of the complete works of Marx, and even Trueba's opera scores, producing a scandalous bonfire that filled the neighborhood with smoke and that in normal times would have brought fire trucks from every direction. "Hand over all your notebooks, your address books, your checkbooks, and all your personal documents," shouted the man who seemed to be in charge. "I'm Senator Trueba, for God's sake, don't you recognize me?" The grandfather shrieked in desperation. "You can't do this to me! This is an outrage! I'm a friend of General Hurtado's!" "Shut up, you old shit! You don't open your mouth until I tell you to," the man replied brutally. They forced him to surrender the contents of his desk and put everything that interested them into paper bags. While one group finished checking the house, another continued throwing books out the window. Four smiling, mocking, threatening men remained in the drawing room. They put their feet up on the furniture, drank the senator's scotch straight from the bottle, and broke his classical records one by one. Alba calculated that at least 2 hours had passed. She was shaking, but not from cold, from fear. She had supposed this moment would come one day, but she had always had the irrational hope that somehow her grandfather's influence would protect her. At the sight of him sitting fearfully on the sofa, tiny and wretched as a sick old man, she understood that she could expect no help. "Sign here," the man in charge ordered Trueba, shoving a piece of paper in his face. "It's a declaration that we entered with a court order, showed you our identification cards, and that everything proceeded properly, with all due respect and proper manners, and that you have no complaints. Sign it." "I'll never sign this," the old man shouted furiously. The man spun around and slapped Alba in the face, a blow that knocked her to the floor. Senator Trueba was paralyzed with terror and surprise. He realized that his hour of truth was finally upon him, after living almost 90 years as his own boss. "Did you know that your granddaughter is the whore of a guerrilla?" the man asked. Dejected, Senator Trueba signed the paper. Then he painfully made his way to his granddaughter and put his arms around her, caressing her hair with unaccustomed tenderness. "Don't worry, my dear. Everything will turn out fine. They can't do anything to you. This is all a terrible mistake," he murmured. "Be calm." But the man shoved them apart and shouted to the others that it was time to go. Two of the men took Alba out, practically lifting her off the floor. The last thing she saw was the pathetic figure of her grandfather, pale as wax, trembling in his nightshirt and shoeless, promising her from the doorway that the next day he would get her out, that he would go speak with General Hurtado, that he would take his lawyers to find her wherever they took her, that he would bring her home. They lifted her into a van alongside the man who had hit her and another who was whistling at the wheel. Before they put adhesive tape over her eyelids, she looked back one last time at the empty, silent street, surprised that despite the uproar and burning books, not a single neighbor had stuck his head out to see what was going on. She supposed that, just as she had done so many times herself, they were peering through the chinks of their Venetian blinds and the space between their curtains, or else they had put pillows over their heads so they would not have to know what was going on. The van started to move. Blind for the first time in her life, she lost all sense of time and space.
She felt a large, wet hand on her leg, kneading, pinching, climbing, and exploring, and then a heavy breath on her face whispering,
"I'm going to warm you up, whore. You'll see."
And other voices and laughter, while the van turned and turned in what seemed to her an endless ride. She did not know where they were taking her until she heard the rush of water and felt the wheels of the van cross planks of wood. Then she knew her destiny. She invoked the spirits of the days of the three-legged table and her grandmother's restless sugar bowl, and all the spirits capable of bending the course of events, but they appeared to have abandoned her, for the van continued on its way. She felt it break, heard the heavy doors of a gate squeak open and shut behind them after they drove through. It was then that Alba entered the nightmare that her grandmother had apparently not seen on her astrological chart when she was born, and that Luisa Mora had seen in a fleeting premonition. The men helped her down. She had not taken two steps before she felt the first blow strike her ribs, and she fell on her knees. The breath knocked out of her. Two men lifted her by the armpits and dragged her a long way. She felt the earth beneath her feet, and then the harsh surface of a cement floor. They stopped. "This is Senator Treba's granddaughter, Colonel," she heard one say.
"So I see," another man replied.
Alba immediately recognized the voice of Esteban Garcia. At that moment, she understood that he had been waiting for her ever since the distant day when he had sat her on his knees when she was just a child. 14. The Hour of Truth. Alba was curled up in the darkness. They had ripped the tape from her eyes and replaced it with a tight bandage. She was afraid, as she recalled her Uncle Nicolás's training and his warning about the danger of being afraid of fear. She concentrated on trying to control the shaking of her body and shutting her ears to the terrifying sounds that reached her side. She tried to visualize her happiest moments with Miguel, groping for a means to outwit time and find the strength for what she knew lay ahead. She told herself that she had to endure a few hours without her nerves betraying her, until her grandfather was able to set in motion the heavy machinery of his power and influence to get her out of there. She searched her memory for a trip to the coast with Miguel in autumn, long before the hurricane of events had turned the world upside down, when things were still called by familiar names and words had a single meaning, when people, freedom, and compañero were just that, people, freedom, and compañero, and had not yet become passwords. She tried to relive that moment, the damp red earth and the intense scent of the pine and eucalyptus forest in which a carpet of dry leaves lay steeping after a long hot summer, and where the coppery sunlight filtered down through the treetops. She tried to recall the cold, the silence, and that precious feeling of owning the world, of being 20 years old and having her whole life ahead of her, of making love slowly and calmly, drunk with the scent of the forest and their love, without a past, without suspecting the future, with just the incredible richness of that present moment in which they stared at each other, smelled each other, kissed each other, and explored each other's bodies, wrapped in the whisper of the wind among the trees and the sound of the nearby waves breaking against the rocks at the foot of the cliff, exploding in a crash of pungent surf, and the two of them embracing underneath a single poncho like Siamese twins, laughing and swearing that this would last forever, that they were the only ones in the whole world who had discovered love. Alba heard the screams, the long moans, and the radio playing full blast. The woods, Miguel, and love were lost in the deep well of her terror and she resigned herself to facing her fate without subterfuge. She calculated that a whole night and the better part of the following day had passed when the door was finally opened and two men took her from her cell. With insults and threats, they led her into Colonel Garcia, whom she could recognize blindfolded by his habitual cruelty, even before he opened his mouth. She felt his hands take her face, his thick fingers touch her ears and neck. "Now you're going to tell me where your lover is," he told her. "That will save us both a lot of unpleasantness." Alba breathed a sigh of relief. That meant they had not arrested Miguel. "I want to go to the bathroom," Alba said, in the strongest voice she could summon up.
"I see you're not planning to cooperate, Alba."
"That's too bad," Garcia sighed.
"The boys will have to do their job. I can't stand in their way."
There was a brief silence, and she made a superhuman effort to remember the pine forest and Miguel's love, but her ideas got tangled up, and she no longer knew if she was dreaming or where the stench of sweat, excrement, blood, and urine was coming from, or the radio announcer describing some Finnish goals that had nothing to do with her in the middle of other, nearer, more clearly audible shouts. A brutal slap knocked her to the floor. Violent hands lifted her to her feet. Ferocious fingers fastened themselves to her breasts, crushing her nipples. She was completely overcome by fear. Strange voices pressed in on her. She heard Miguel's name, but did not know what they were asking her, and kept repeating a monumental no while they beat her, manhandled her, pulled off her blouse, and she could no longer think, could only say no, no, and no, and calculate how much longer she could resist before her strength gave out, not knowing this was only the beginning, until she felt herself begin to faint, and the men left her alone, lying on the floor, for what seemed to her a very short time. She soon heard Garcia's voice again, and guessed it was his hands that were helping her to her feet, leading her toward a chair, straightening her clothes and buttoning her blouse.
"My God," he said, "look what they've done to you. I warned you, Alba. Try to relax now. I'm going to give you a cup of coffee."
Alba began to cry. The warm liquid brought her back to life, but she could not taste it because when she swallowed it, it was mixed with blood. Garcia held the cup, guiding it carefully toward her lips like a nurse.
"Do you want a cigarette?"
"I want to go to the bathroom," she said,
pronouncing each syllable with difficulty with her swollen lips.
"Of course, Alba. They'll take you to the bathroom and then you can get some rest. I'm your friend. I understand your situation perfectly. You're in love, and that's why you want to protect him. I know you don't have anything to do with the guerrillas, but the boys don't believe me when I tell them. They won't be satisfied until you tell them where Miguel is. Actually, they've already got him surrounded. They know exactly where he is. They'll catch him, but they want to be sure that you have nothing to do with the guerrillas, you understand. If you protect him and refuse to talk, they'll continue to suspect you. Tell them what they want to know, and then I'll personally escort you home. You'll tell them, right?"
"I want to go to the bathroom," Alba repeated.
"I see you're just as stubborn as your grandfather. All right, you can go to the bathroom. I'm going to give you a chance to think things over," Garcia said.
They took her to a toilet, and she was forced to ignore the man who stood beside her, holding onto her arm. After that, they returned her to her cell. In the tiny, solitary cube where she was being held, she tried to clarify her thoughts, but she was tortured by the pain of her beating, her thirst, the bandage pressing on her temples, the drone of the radio, the terror of approaching footsteps, and her relief when they moved away. The shouts and the orders. She curled up like a fetus on the floor and surrendered to her pain. She remained in that position for hours, perhaps days. A man came twice to take her to the bathroom. He led her to a fetid lavatory where she was unable to wash because there was no water. He allowed her a minute, placing her on the toilet seat next to another person as silent and sluggish as herself. She could not tell if it was a woman or a man. At first she wept, wishing her Uncle Nicolas had given her a special course in how to withstand humiliation, which she found worse than pain. But she finally resigned herself to her own filth and stopped thinking about her unbearable need to wash. They gave her boiled corn, a small piece of chicken, and a bit of ice cream, which she identified by their taste, smell, and temperature, and which she wolfed down with her hands, astonished to be given such luxurious food, unexpected in a place like that. Afterward, she learned that the food for the prisoners in that torture center was supplied by the new headquarters of the government, which was in an improvised building, since the old presidential palace was a pile of rubble. She tried to count the days since she was first arrested, but her loneliness, the darkness, and her fear distorted her sense of time and space. She thought she saw caves filled with monsters. She imagined that she had been drugged, and that was why her limbs were so weak and sluggish, and why her ideas had grown so jumbled. She decided not to eat or drink anything, but hunger and thirst were stronger than her determination. She wondered why her grandfather still had not come to rescue her. In her rare moments of lucidity, she understood that this was not a nightmare and that she was not there by mistake. She decided to forget everything she knew, even Miguel's name. The third time they took her in to Esteban Garcia, Alba was more prepared, because through the walls of her cell, she could hear what was going on in the next room, where they were interrogating other prisoners, and she had no illusions. She did not even try to evoke the woods where she had shared the joy of love. "Well, Alba, I've given you time to think things over. Now the two of us are going to talk, and you are going to tell me where Miguel is, and we're going to get this over with quickly," Garcia said. "I want to go to the bathroom," Alba answered. "I see you're making fun of me, Alba," he said. "I'm sorry, but we don't have any time to waste." Alba made no response. "Take off your clothes," Garcia ordered in another voice. She did not obey. They stripped her violently, pulling off her slacks despite her kicking. The memory of her adolescence and Garcia's kiss in the garden gave her the strength of hatred. She struggled against him until they got tired of beating her and gave her a short break, which she used to invoke the understanding spirits of her grandmother so that they would help her die. But no one answered her call for help. Two hands lifted her up, and four laid her on a cold, hard metal cot with springs that hurt her back and bound her wrists and ankles with leather thongs. "For the last time, Alba, where is Miguel?" Garcia asked. She shook her head in silence. They had tied her head down with another thong. "When you're ready to talk, raise a finger," he said. Alba heard another voice. "I'll work the machine," it said. Then she felt the atrocious pain that coursed through her body, filling it completely, and that she would never forget as long as she lived. She sank into darkness. "Bastards, I told you to be careful with her," she heard Esteban Garcia say from far away. She felt them opening her eyelids, but all she saw was a misty brightness. Then she felt a prick in her arm and sank back into unconsciousness. A century later, Alba awoke wet and naked. She did not know if she was bathed with sweat or water or urine. She could not move,
recalled nothing, and had no idea where she was or what had caused the intense pain that had reduced her to a heap of raw meat. She felt the thirst of the Sahara and called out for water.
"Wait, compañera," someone said beside her. "Wait until morning. If you drink water, you'll get convulsions and you could die."
She opened her eyes. They were no longer bandaged. A vaguely familiar face was leaning over her, and hands were wrapping her in a blanket.
"Do you remember me? I'm Ana Diaz. We went to the university together. Don't you recognize me?"
Alba shook her head, closed her eyes, and surrendered to the sweet illusion of death. But she awakened a few hours later, and when she moved, she realized that she ached to the last fiber of her body.
"You'll feel better soon," said a woman who was stroking her face and pushing away the locks of damp hair that hid her eyes. "Don't move, and try to relax. I'll be here next to you. You need to rest."
"What happened?" Alba whispered.
"They really roughed you up, compañera," the other woman said sadly.
"Who are you?"
Alba asked.
"Ana Diaz. I've been here for a week. They also got my compañero Andrés, but he's still alive. I see him once a day, when they take them to the bathroom."
"Ana Diaz," Alba murmured.
"That's right. We weren't so close back then, but it's never too late to start. The truth is, you're the last person I expected to meet here, Countess," the woman said gently. "Don't talk now. Try to sleep. That way the time will go faster for you. Your memory will gradually come back. Don't worry. It's because of the electricity."
But Alba was unable to sleep, for the door of her cell opened and a man walked in. "Put the bandage back on her," he ordered Ana Diaz.
"Please, can't you see how weak she is? Let her rest a little while."
"Do as I say." Ana bent over the cot and put the bandage over her eyes. Then she removed the blanket and tried to dress her, but the guard pulled her away, lifted the prisoner by her arms, and sat her up. Another man came in to help him, and between them they carried her out because she could not walk. Alba was sure that she was dying, if she was not already dead. She could tell they were walking down a hallway in which the sound of their footsteps echoed. She felt a hand on her face, lifting her head.
"You can give her water. Wash her and give her another shot. See if she can swallow some coffee and bring her back to me," Garcia said.
"Do you want us to dress her?"
"No."
Alba was in Garcia's hands a long time. After a few days, he realized she had recognized him, but he did not abandon his precaution of keeping her blindfolded. Even when they were alone, every day new prisoners arrived and others were led away. Alba heard the vehicles, the shouts, and the gate being closed. She tried to keep track of the number of prisoners, but it was almost impossible. Ana Diaz thought there were close to 200. Garcia was very busy, but he never let a day go by without seeing Alba, alternating unbridled violence with the pretense that he was her good friend. At times he appeared to be genuinely moved, personally spooning soup into her mouth. But the day he plunged her head into a bucket full of excrement until she fainted from disgust, Alba understood that he was not trying to learn Miguel's true whereabouts, but to avenge himself for injuries that had been inflicted on him from birth, and that nothing she could confess would have any effect on her fate as the private prisoner of Colonel Garcia. This allowed her to venture slowly out of the private circle of her terror. Her fear began to ebb, and she was able to feel compassion for the others, for those they hung by their arms, for the newcomers, for the man whose shackled legs were run over by a truck. They brought all the prisoners into the courtyard at dawn and forced them to watch, because this was also a personal matter between the colonel and his prisoner.
It was the first time Alba had opened her eyes outside the darkness of her cell, and the gentle splendor of the morning, and the frost shining on the stones where puddles of rain had collected overnight, seemed unbearably radiant to her. They dragged the man, who offered no resistance, out into the courtyard. He could not stand, and they left him lying on the ground. The guards had covered their faces with handkerchiefs, so no one would ever be able to identify them in the improbable event that circumstances changed. Alba closed her eyes when she heard the truck's engine, but she could not close her ears to the sound of his howl, which stayed in her memory forever. Ana Diaz helped her to resist while they were together. She was an indomitable woman. She had withstood every form of cruelty. They had raped her in the presence of her lover and tortured them together, but she had not lost her capacity to smile or her hope. She did not give in even when they had transferred her to a secret clinic of the political police because one of the beatings had caused her to lose the child she was carrying, and she had begun to hemorrhage. "It doesn't matter," she told Alba when she returned to her cell. "Someday I'll have another one." That night, Alba heard her cry for the first time, covering her face with her blanket to suffocate her grief. She went to her and put her arms around her, rocking her and wiping her tears. She told her all the tender things she could think of, but that night there was no comfort for Ana Diaz, so Alba simply rocked her in her arms, lulling her to sleep like a tiny baby, and wishing she could take on her shoulders the terrible pain of Ana's soul. Dawn found them huddled together like two small animals. During the day, they anxiously awaited the moment when the long line of men went by on their way to the latrine. They were blindfolded, and to guide themselves, each had his hand on the shoulder of the man ahead of him, watched over by armed guards. Among the prisoners was Andres. From the tiny barred window of their cell, the women could see them, so close that if they had been able to reach out, they could have touched them. Each time they passed, Ana and Alba sang with the strength of their despair, and female voices rose from the other cells. Then the prisoners would stand up tall, straighten their backs, and turn their heads in the direction of the women's cells, and Andres would smile. His shirt was torn and covered with dry blood. One of the guards was moved by the women's hymns. One night, he brought them three carnations in a can of water to put in their window. Another time, he came to tell Ana Diaz that he needed a volunteer to wash one of the prisoner's clothes and clean out his cell. He led her to where Andres was and left them alone together for a few minutes. When Ana Diaz returned, she was transfigured. Alba did not dare speak to her so as not to break the spell of her happiness. One day, Colonel Garcia was surprised to find himself caressing Alba like a lover and talking to her of his childhood in the country when he would see her walking hand in hand with her grandfather, dressed in her starched pinafores and with the green halo of her hair, while he, barefoot in the mud, swore that one day he would make her pay for her arrogance and avenge himself for his cursed bastard fate. Rigid and absent, naked and trembling with disgust and cold, Alba neither heard nor felt him. But that crack in his eagerness to torture her sounded an alarm in the colonel's mind. He ordered Alba to be thrown in the doghouse and furiously prepared to forget that she existed. The doghouse was a small, sealed cell like a dark, frozen, airless tomb. There were six of them altogether, constructed in an empty water tank especially for punishment. They were used for relatively short stretches of time, because no one could withstand them very long, at most a few days, before beginning to ramble, to lose the sense of things, the meaning of words, and the anxiety of passing time, or simply, beginning to die. At first, huddled in her sepulcher,
Unable either to stand up or sit down despite her small size, Alba managed to stave off madness. Now that she was alone, she realized how much she needed Ana Díaz.